Robin.
Hey, I'm so glad to be back together for another episode of the Good Kids, Better World podcast, talking about things that all relate to raising good kids who will make a better world.
I am too. And I'm so grateful to all the people who keep coming back to listen. I mean, we think what we're saying is critically important, but it's so great to see others do too. And even though our regular listeners already know, let's just say again what we mean when we say good kids.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good idea. We say a good kid speaks up, speaks out, and notices injustice. A good kid cares about their family, their school, their friends, and their community. A good kid is learning to be anti-racist, feminist, inclusive of all genders, identities, sexual orientations, and abilities. And above all, a good kid is striving to make a better world. And in this podcast and also on our blog, we use some guiding principles or values to talk about these things. And some of our earlier episodes have talked about respect and courage, repairing the world. And today's episode is going to be about remembering.
Right. Like remembering things that have happened in the past to help inform what we do in the future. And you brought us a story to tell today.
I sure did. So when my son was four, he's 12 and a half now, but when my son was four, he went to a preschool at a local synagogue, and outside that synagogue, they built a statue of a giant paperclip as a Holocaust memorial. And I'm not sure if people are familiar with the reason why a paperclip is related to the Holocaust. I didn't at the time, and unsurprisingly, neither did my preschooler. Also, unsurprisingly, he asked me about it, so I did some research. And the short story is that there was a group of largely white and Christian students in rural Tennessee learning about the Holocaust. And in order to help them grasp the enormity of the 6 million Jews who were killed, they collected 6 million paperclips. And they did paperclips because they had learned through their research that Norwegians had worn paperclips on their lapels as a symbol of silent protest against Nazi occupation during the war. So it actually turned into a really big thing, and they ended up filling an authentic German rail car with the paperclips to make a permanent memorial. And we will link to that story in the show notes. It's actually, there's a documentary about it. My parents actually went and saw the rail car when they went on a trip to Tennessee. It was really cool. And they didn't know about it at all. So that was really cool. Anyway, if memory serves, I gave my son like a super basic explanation of who Hitler was and why he was very bad. And he sort of listened and nodded. And after a few minutes of thinking, he goes, and like, I remember this perfectly clearly. He goes, Hitler does sound mean, but the Wicked Witch of the West was definitely meaner. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I said something like, but the Wicked Witch killed no Jews. But it didn't matter to him at the time. I mean, he was four and the Wicked Witch was the pinnacle of terrible. So in essence, right, Asher's known about the Holocaust since he was four. And in large part, because I think it's really important to speak honestly about history and remember it so that he has a basis upon which to act as he grows into an adult. I mean, that said, it's not like I was showing him Schindler's List at 4 years old. There's a fine line between teaching to remember and traumatizing children, which I know our guests will talk about. And we have certainly talked about it many times since then. Like I said, he's 12 and a half now. He has a much deeper understanding of, you know, the very specific atrocities that happened and the story. But, you know, it was definitely a story that, you know, we started talking about when he was very small.
And I think it's hard for most parents to think about telling their kids. I know it's something that I've really struggled with, talking to your kids about things that are really difficult from the past, things that you just wish weren't so. And so that's why I'm really excited today to be talking about remembering as an actual value, and also about our guests who are going to come on and really help us understand how do you talk to kids at different ages about these kinds of things.
Right.
But before we dive into that, we're going to start off like we always do with a little levity, a little fun.
Is it wrong to say that this is like what I look forward to every week? This is super fun. I'm excited.
Absolutely. Okay, so as we said, the theme of today's podcast is the value of remembering. And so for our game today, I thought we could see how much you remember about history.
Oh, stop. It's very little. I can tell you right now, it's very little, unless it's sixth grade history, because I just taught that this year.
Okay, I have a random assortment of well-known historical events, and I'm going to put my timer on for 45 seconds.
Oh, no.
And I want to see how many years you can get for these events.
Okay. Year, okay. Like the exact year, the exact.
You want like a 2-4 year window?
I would like a window. I would like a window.
Okay. Five years either end.
All right. Okay.
5 years either end. Okay. So you got to get within the decade, basically. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Here we go. The publication of Darwin's The Origin of Species.
It was 1652.
Absolutely not. 1859.
Okay. Good.
Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan is published.
I don't even ever even heard of that.
Moving on. William Shakespeare is born.
1225.
1564. Okay. New Zealand introduces unrestricted women's suffrage.
This is a well-known history fact. Shut up. All right. 1911.
1893. That's close-ish. Okay. All right. First book printed with movable type.
What's movable type?
You know, it's printed.
Oh. 1725.
1455. You got zero. Okay.
Well, those were really hard. That was a very obscure trivia game. How far did you have to dig into the internet to find these facts?
Not very far at all.
Okay. Just a quick reminder for our listeners about how we're using themes and values in this podcast. So I just want to, we're both Jewish, so our inclination is to refer back to the way we learned about these values. But values are values, so whether we're using the Hebrew word for it, which is zachor in this case, it doesn't really matter.
Exactly. And before we welcome our guests, I just want to give a little more explanation about this value of zachor or remember. One of the most frequently repeated commandments in the Torah is to remember that you too were strangers, to think about the stranger, to remember the stranger, to care for the stranger, because you were once strangers as well. So this idea of remembering carries through. And in the 20th century, Jews took on the saying, you know, it's sort of like a hashtag, but long before hashtags were in vogue, we have been saying, never forget. And that is in reference to the Holocaust. We teach our children to remember not only what they themselves see and hear, but the memories that the world needs us to remember. So we also need to teach our children in a way to remember slavery, to remember genocide, to remember segregation, oppression, and many other difficult parts of our history.
Our guests today are two teachers, Hina McCafferty and Adina Baseman Sharfstein. Hina is in her 11th year teaching young children. She taught preschool and first grade in Boston before having her children, and she returned to teaching in the second grade after 10 years of being a stay-at-home mom.
Adina has been teaching for 31 years and is now a fifth grade teacher of the gifted and a Holocaust educator. She writes curriculum on the Holocaust and trains educators across Broward County, Florida. She won the Holocaust Education Award from Florida Atlantic University and attended, as part of that award, the March of the Living.
Adina and Hina, welcome to the Good Kids, Better World podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for including us.
So you're both educators in public elementary schools, and part of that work means teaching history to kids that include difficult stories and some of like the uglier parts of humanity. So can you each talk a little bit about the history that you have taught?
I teach the Holocaust to fifth graders, and some people would be surprised that that topic is taught in elementary school. It is actually a mandate in the state of Florida to teach Holocaust education grades K through 12. And, wow. You know, it's important to realize that there are many different aspects to this topic. The Holocaust is a vast topic, and you're obviously not going to be teaching about concentration camps and crematoriums to primary age students. What we teach in elementary school are the lessons of the Holocaust, mm-hmm. which are acceptance of differences. We are teaching the lessons of diversity and inclusion, and we're teaching students how to be upstanders. Like you said in your introduction, a good kid speaks up, speaks out, and notices injustice. That's the purpose of teaching the Holocaust. And when I teach the Holocaust to my students, I ask them, why do they think we are learning about this when they see how difficult it is to learn about? And they always come to the conclusion, so we don't forget, so this doesn't happen again. Right. And that's the point.
Mm-hmm. I teach second grade, and we teach about Native Americans, Indigenous people. And when I joined 5 years ago, it wasn't laid out exactly what we needed to teach. It was just a general topic that was given to us. And so our team decided to focus on teaching about Native Americans and Indigenous people as authentically as we can. Because the children are 7 and 8 year olds, we are not focusing so much on the atrocities that the Native American Indigenous people have had to endure, but rather teaching them the foundation about who these people are and what cultures and traditions they have that are to be honored and accepted. As Adina said, they're primary age students, and it's laying the foundation for a conversation, hopefully, that they'll have later on or at home if they're ready for it.
Can you guys give us a couple of examples of, you know, how you teach? And so what I mean by that is, I think for people who aren't trained as educators, who don't teach professionally, sometimes we think when we're talking about history, we mean we tell you, right? This happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. But that a lot more goes on in the classroom. So can you talk a little bit about what it looks like to teach these topics?
So the way I do it with such young children is to kind of start with where they are. So before we even begin this unit, I give them a blank piece of paper and say, draw me what you know about Native Americans and Indigenous people, or Indians. We use all the terms. I don't use Indian that much because I am Indian. And so that's how I start with the unit, which is unique to me, where I say, I'm an Indian from India. So I try not to use the label Indians to represent Native American Indigenous people. However, there are some Native American Indigenous people who do prefer to be called Indians. So we kind of use those terms interchangeably throughout the lesson, but I just ask the children to draw what they know. And, you know, as can be expected, most of the time I get teepees and tomahawks and feathers and cowboys. And what's interesting through the years, I see less and less of that, which is really encouraging. A lot of times I get a blank piece of paper. I don't know, which is easier. I'm not trying to correct misconceptions. I'm just teaching on a blank piece of paper. But I usually say with any topic that's challenging, start by asking, so what do you know? Because that will tell you where to go next.
Like you, I usually begin my unit with a KWL chart. K means what I know about a topic, and W is what I want to know, and then the L is what I have learned about that topic. So we do a KWL chart across the fifth grade. What do you know about the Holocaust? And unless a child is either Jewish or a real World War II History Channel buff, they don't know anything. And we always tell them that it's perfectly fine to say, I don't know anything. That's why they're in school. Mm-hmm. And then what they want to learn, and if they say they know nothing, they want to know everything. And then at the end, we keep the papers till the end of the unit, and then they can fill it out at the end. We actually do something really unique, I think, at our school. It started about 2012 when a book was published called Wonder. And the entire fifth grade starts off reading that novel. So we read the book Wonder, which doesn't have anything to do with the Holocaust in that book, but it has to do with the lessons of the Holocaust, of acceptance of differences, of being an upstander, of being a friend to the friendless. That's how we begin our year. And the theme of Wonder is choose kind. So that becomes our theme throughout the year. When we start learning about the Holocaust and the students have done their KWL charts, we do a big assembly with everybody in the room, and we share a PowerPoint with them, a presentation, where we start from the bottom up. What does the word Holocaust mean? The definition of the word. What was the Holocaust? The period of time that it took place from 1933 to 1945. We use vocabulary words and define them like propaganda, scapegoat. We want them to know what a swastika looks like, that the origin of the swastika used to be a Hindu symbol of prosperity and success. And Adolf Hitler took that symbol, inverted it, and changed it.
I will say on that note, just being Hindu, because it was a Hindu symbol of prosperity, inverted, and the Hindu symbol also has dots on it. Yes. So in my house, we have it up, the Hindu symbol, not the Nazi symbol.
I understand.
But the Hindu symbol, because in our religious altars and things like that, and my friends would come over, and their eyes would just bug out. And I was like, it's not what it is. And so we learned very quickly in my family, my parents are immigrants, and they learned that they could not use that symbol.
And that is exactly why we teach that. Because again, acceptance of differences, that this was used to be a symbol in another culture and another religion that was a positive symbol. And now Adolf Hitler turned it around and made it into such a negative symbol. I continue with the Nuremberg Laws, which was slowly stripping away the rights of Jewish citizens in Germany. The Nuremberg Laws, like boycotting of Jewish shops, boycotting of Jewish doctors and lawyers, where the public schools, parks, and pools were forbidden for Jews. Marriages between Jews and non-Jews were forbidden. The forced wearing of the Yellow Star of David. These were all laws that were gradually added. And the final one was taking of Jewish businesses and homes. And that's when we talk about Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht was the night of broken glass, November 9th through 10th in 1938, when Adolf Hitler told his police force to smash and destroy and burn Jewish-owned businesses and synagogues and homes. We talk about, you know, what would you do if your house was on fire? Mm-hmm. You would call the firefighters. Well, what if it was the firefighters that set the blaze? That's when the Jews were rounded up and taken to a place called a ghetto. We talk about what a ghetto was. We talk about how families were only able to bring what they could carry. And for many families, they brought things that were family heirlooms, like silver candlesticks, a Seder plate that had been in the family for years and years, family heirlooms. We talk about the conditions in the ghetto being horrible, and the disease and the sickness and the lack of food. And then we do talk about deportations to concentration camps. We mention the names of concentration camps. They should know the names of Auschwitz, Birkenau, Dachau, Treblinka, Theresien, Bergen-Belsen, Theresienstadt. We talk about the deportations on the trains, taking days, having no place to sit down, having no place to go to the bathroom, no food, no water for days. And we talk about when they arrived at the concentration camps that the families were separated. Men to one side, women and children to the other. We talk about the gas chambers. We talk about the crematoriums. We talk about those who were lucky enough to be allowed to live being forced slave labor and the appalling conditions. Not an easy day. Mm-hmm. We talk about the numbers of people that were murdered. The total is approximately 11 million. 6 million people were murdered because they were Jewish. 5 million other people who Hitler and the Nazis thought were opposed to the Third Reich, which was their empire. Roma, physically impaired people, mentally impaired people, members of the LGBTQ community, Black people, anybody who opposed the Nazis were all put to death. Mm-hmm. A total of 11 million people were killed. And of that number, 1.5 million were children. I mentioned that Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel said that not everyone who was persecuted was Jewish, but everyone who was Jewish was persecuted. Mm. And why do we study the Holocaust? George Santayana said, "Those who do not learn from the past are destined to repeat it." What does that mean? It takes good people to be silent for evil to triumph. Yeah. Mm. I take questions. I always get questions like, were there people that tried to help? And then we talk about resistance and we talk about the righteous Gentiles. Now realize, this PowerPoint is in one day, but where our unit goes over a course of many months, and I do show movies. One of the movies I show is Paperclips, and I was so mm-hmm. glad Robin mentioned it,
yeah,
because it is a fantastic documentary about the school in Whitwell, Tennessee. The reason that the school did this was because they have no diversity in their town. They have, they're white and they're Protestant. They have maybe one Black person, a couple of Hispanic people, no Jews.
And this was a volunteer, like after school, like the kids were like, we want to learn about this.
It was a club.
Yeah.
The assistant principal and a social studies teacher said, let's have an after school club. And we're going to learn about the Holocaust. We're going to learn about diversity. We're going to learn about the fact that not everybody in the world is white and Protestant. Mm-hmm. And it grew and it blossomed from there. The paperclip, as you mentioned, was actually invented by the Norwegians. And the Norwegians wore the paperclip on their lapels in solidarity with the Jews when the Jews had to wear the yellow stars of David. So when the club was thinking, how do we even understand the enormity of 6 million of something? What if we collected something? They were trying to think what it would be small that we could collect. And that's how they came to the idea of the paperclip. Paperclips also symbolize holding things together. And so, yes, they were successful in collecting 6 million paperclips. They actually collected more than that. But then they thought, where can we house them? And with the help of a couple from Germany who were journalists, they were able to procure a real railroad car that had actually transported people to Auschwitz, and it traveled from Germany across the ocean on September 11th, 2001.
Oh.
So while we were being attacked on our own shores, that car was coming to Tennessee. They set it up. The entire community was involved in gardening and putting flowers, and an artist created stepping stones made in the shapes of butterflies. Another symbol of the Holocaust, and especially of the children who lost their lives in the Holocaust, was the butterfly. Because number one, a butterfly's life is very short, but very beautiful. And another reason is that there were some poems and drawings made by children that were discovered after the Holocaust was over. And one of the poems was called The Last Butterfly, and it was written by Pavel Friedman at the age of 14. Who later perished in Auschwitz, but he talked about living in the ghetto and that butterflies don't live in here.
Yeah.
So an artist made butterfly stepping stones to lead up to the railway car, and it is now a museum. And there are field trips taken to this little school in Whitwell, Tennessee to see the paperclip museum. So if you are interested, it's still there.
That's a really great story. And I actually I'm taking a road trip with my son in a few days, and we are going to Tennessee, but it's just a little too far off our route. And I was like, I was sort of reminded about it because this, you know, there's a synagogue. It's like 5-10 minutes from my house that has this big paperclip in front of it. And it, I'm sure, inspires a lot of questions and stories as people drive by. So Hina, I wanted to ask you, your students are young. And so you're not doing a lot of real graphic education with them about, you know, you're sort of laying the foundation with them. But I know that one of the great opportunities you have right in the beginning of the year with these 7-year-olds is Thanksgiving. And that is, yeah, you know, traditionally it's the pilgrims and the Indians sat down together and had a great big feast and they loved each other. So I was wondering if there are ways that you can sort of use that opportunity to tell the true story of history.
Yeah, you know, we don't really get into the falsehood of Thanksgiving and how it wasn't, you know, I grew up in Boston, and so we had Plymouth Rock, and we lived the pilgrims, right? And so like, it was very much a part of my upbringing and part of the story around that time of year. And so we don't go into, especially we tend to do our Native American Indigenous People unit in the springtime when they're a little bit older. So we don't hit it at the beginning of the year, so that when Thanksgiving is rolling around, we haven't really touched upon the topic at all yet. But what I tend to do is, first of all, in my classroom, we celebrate all the holidays. So if you celebrate a holiday, I will approach you and ask, you know, I'm very careful that I don't want to make the children be ambassadors of their culture. So if that is something that they do not want to share, or something that they'd rather not share, then that's within their right to say, no, I'm good. I don't want to share that with the class. But some children, usually 7 and 8-year-olds, are very eager to share anything about themselves. So I like to use this as an opportunity before they get that self-consciousness of, I don't really want to stand out, I kind of hone on that and say, oh, so, you know, I know that you, for example, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, I've learned so much because you know, students in my class will say, well, I'll bring in a book, or I'll teach you about the apples and honey. And, oh, we have this tradition, we have that tradition. I'm very open about sharing my culture of Diwali and Navratri, which are fall, autumn holidays. There's a lot of holidays in the autumn. So we really have this conversation from September so that when Thanksgiving hits, we focus more on the traditions of Thanksgiving and the modern day traditions. So we don't really go into the first Thanksgiving and where it necessarily originated with the historical piece, but we talk about why it's a national holiday. We use it as a day of thanks, a day of celebration, a day to get together with our families, and a day to basically break bread. But what I think what's more important than what I do is what I don't do. So I am very, very careful to not have any word searches with pilgrims and Indians. There's no books out about pilgrims and Indians. There might be one first Thanksgiving book amongst many other Thanksgiving books that are focusing more on the tradition of Thanksgiving and less on the actual first Thanksgiving. And so we don't do the whole dressing up for Thanksgiving. And it actually,
wait, you don't do the whole construction paper headband with a feather sticking out the
Oh my gosh, no. Yeah. Oh, cringe. I cringe. I mean, I've thrown away so many papers that have just, even if it's gotten to the point where I've gotten so sensitive, even if it just has a pilgrim hat in the corner, mm-hmm. I'm like, nope, we don't need that. Like, I just don't see the need for it. We can do this other ways. And so just making sure that narrative that we all grew up with is not being perpetuated forward. And it permeated my house for the first time, my home, this Thanksgiving, as I'm pulling out. And this is what I encourage listeners, you know, as parents, we have traditional Thanksgiving decorations that we pull out every year as we prepare for the Thanksgiving table. And for the first year, I pulled out my pilgrim man and pilgrim woman, went to go put them on the mantle. And I looked at them, and my then 13-year-old looked at me, and I looked at her, and this is unspoken. And I looked at her, I'm like, I can't do this, can I? And she's like, nope. And they went right in. And then we struggled for a little while. Do we put them in the giveaway bin, which means somebody else is going to perpetuate them? Or do we throw them away? Because what needs to happen is they need to be thrown away, not put on somebody else's mantle.
You know, I thought it was interesting when you said, we can do this another way.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, I feel like, an important thing to remember. It's not, you don't have to, you know, as a parent or a teacher, you don't have to give up Thanksgiving. You don't have to stop talking about, you know, anything really. You can do it another way. And it takes, you know, it might take a little effort. It might take a little bit of research, but there are other, you know, you can still remember in ways that are appropriate for their ages, for their development. You can still do it. You can still talk about it.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting part of this false Thanksgiving story, is that we created for generations a memory that didn't exist. We like gave people a memory and we invented it. And so the idea of this episode is about memory and about remembering as a value. And so what do we choose to remember? You know, what are we going to pass along to memory? I think memory is a really tricky thing. You know, we know from like court cases and science that people don't remember things accurately. We can't always trust our own memories. And I remember when I was in college watching the old movie Rashomon, and it tells the same story from all these different characters' perspectives, and they're like vastly different stories, mm-hmm. which I think we can all relate to, that we can tell the same story and yet it's a completely different tale. So I'm wondering, when we teach these sort of difficult stories, difficult histories to children, whether we choose to be careful about the positive aspects we teach, or whether we're diving into those even more difficult pieces, what do you think we should be thinking about when it comes to the perspective that we're teaching? Like, how do we choose the stories that we tell? Which of these memories are we passing along?
I think it's easier. I'm going to be honest, as an educator, we are in especially primary school, but I have a lot of friends who are in middle and high school who I always thought had it easy because they taught one grade, one subject all day long, but I found it's very challenging for them too. But as educators, we're constantly chasing our tail. We're constantly moving. We're constantly trying to get everything done in a short amount of time. And I think it's very easy. And I think parents are the same way, where, you know, most parents are working and have multiple children and activities, and they're also chasing their tail. And I think it's easier to just fall back on what we know and not stop and think about what we don't know and the different perspectives. Like you said, Anna, we create memories based on what we've been taught and what we already know, and that it is hard to stop and say, wait a minute, there's another side to this story, and taking the time. And I think sometimes it can be as easy as just saying, so this is what I know. And there's some other stories out there, and you should probably find out the other sides too. If you don't have the time as an educator or as a parent to give all the perspectives, because there just isn't time on every topic or on every difficult issue to give all the perspectives, I often say, well, this is one idea, and then give the idea so that at least it is being presented as an idea and not the idea. Mm-hmm. And I think that as educators, it was funny. I had my oldest, she was like 5, and she said to me something about God and said, Mom, what is there a God, or something very general like that. And I remember starting with my educator hat being like, well, some people believe this and some people believe that. And that, wait a minute, you're my kid. I get to tell you exactly what I believe. And so I got to actually give her my opinion. But, I did, but I also did say, and that's what we believe, but there are other people who believe other things. And I think that is a way to at least place this in the grand story. And so then children, we don't have to have all the answers. We don't have to give them all the perspectives, but we just need to let them know that there are more than one. And that if they want help finding the answers, we can help them with it. Or it's something they can do when they're a little bit older, if they would like to get the varying stories. I think it's a difficult thing when we just present it as the story.
Yeah. And we're in a unique, it's not unique anymore, really. It's unique compared to how I grew up. You know, we're in a good time for seeking information. Information is so available. You know, if someone said to me, well, I don't know, you could go research it, I'd be like, I get to the library and look at the car catalog. Like, it's like not as intriguing an opportunity, really. Whereas, my son is like, hey Siri, how many Jews were killed in the Holocaust? You can ask any question. Our kids are lucky to be growing up in this time where that information is so available.
Yeah. And my daughter recently, I think it's about a year ago or so before the pandemic, saw a card catalog and was like, what is that? I was explaining to her, oh, this is how libraries work. This is how it's organized and how you would look things up. And she just looked at me like, why in the world would anybody do that? She just was so lost. I think this really brings up an important piece though, that Adina was getting to before about why do we teach certain aspects? Why is it important, for example, to recognize Hitler's face, or why is it important to recognize a swastika and the difference between a swastika and a Hindu symbol? And I think part of it is, right, we want to teach our kids not just these facts. I mean, I'm happy to hear more from you, Adina, about this, but we also want to teach them how to be critical thinkers, because there is so much information. Lots of it is very good and lots of it is not. And we want to help them know how to sift through that.
Absolutely. I did train at Yad Vashem, which is the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Jerusalem, Israel. And one of the things they taught us as educators is when you are teaching students about the Holocaust, your job is to bring them safely in and safely out.
Mm-hmm.
And to be very critical about the books that we choose and the movies that we show. I use a novel called Number the Stars by Lois Lowry, an award-winning book. It is a piece of historical fiction, and normally they would caution against using fiction. There are so much true story. There are so many survivor stories out there. However, this book is an exception because it really talks about how the country of Denmark saved almost all of their Jews. The entire country worked together, were the resistance, safely smuggled to Sweden, which was a neutral country, across the water, and used fishing boats to do that. It is suspenseful. It is not gory. It is not nightmare inducing. It is beautifully written. If you've not read Number the Stars by Lois Lowry, I should get plugs for all of these books. I'm telling you, Wonder and Number the Stars are wonderful, wonderful books to use. But I wanted to talk about our value today of remembering. You know, in Judaism, our holidays are all about remembering. When we have a Passover Seder, it is a mitzvah to sit with your family and retell the story of when we were slaves in Egypt and the Exodus out of Egypt. That is the mitzvah. That is the commandment to remember. So it is a commandment, really, to remember. And it is important when we're talking about different perspectives. We are not going to be teaching from the perspective of the Nazi. We're going to be teaching from the perspective of people who were being vilified for who they were. Mm-hmm. And we do like to talk about people who fought back in the resistance and people who tried to help. Mm-hmm. We don't want to glamorize the rescuers. Mm-hmm. If there were so many rescuers, we wouldn't have 6 million Jewish people murdered. Yeah. However, there are such incredible stories of courage and bravery and sacrifice that are true and more thrilling than any piece of fiction that could have been written. We focus on Nicholas Winton. I don't know if you've heard of Sir Nicholas Winton. He was a Christian 29-year-old who decided when he went to Prague, he needed to help get the children out of Czechoslovakia. Saved 669 children on something similar to the Kinder transport, getting them out. And he never told anybody about it. And it wasn't until he was quite an elderly man that his wife found some documents in their attic and questioned him about it. And it wasn't that he was keeping it a secret. He just was not looking for glory, wasn't looking for any accolades. He did what he thought was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And there's a wonderful clip. If you Google Sir Nicholas Winton on the BBC, he was invited to a talk show and the talk show host was telling his story. What he didn't know was that the entire studio audience was made up of children he had saved.
Oh, wow.
I dare you not to cry when you watch it. Another Holocaust hero was a woman named Irena Sendler. Irena Sendler was Polish Christian, and she worked kind of for the Red Cross in Poland. And so because of that, she was given access to the Warsaw Ghetto. She was allowed to go in and out with very rudimentary medical supplies. And when she went in and saw the children, she decided she had to take action and get them out. She formed a team, and they smuggled out over 2,000 Jewish children from the Warsaw Ghetto, one at a time, through various methods. She was taken in and interrogated and tortured. They wanted the names of her group. She never gave it away, and she was supposed to be executed, and her group bribed a Nazi guard who was guarding her and helped her escape. Wow. So she escaped, and she lived out the rest of her days up until her 90s, not telling anybody what she had done. And a couple of schoolgirls in Kansas were doing a history project and fell upon a little blurb somewhere and started researching, and the story bloomed. So if you want to also Google Irena Sendler, Life in a Jar, these two high schoolers wrote a play about her because she would have to convince the parents to let their children go, and would write down the child's name and the parent's name on a piece of paper so that if by some chance they could be reunited after the war, she wanted to be able to do that. And she kept all the pieces of paper and filled them into a jar. And when the jar was full, she buried it under the tree in her backyard. She filled so many jars, they were underneath her tree. So Life in a Jar was the play that these students wrote. They actually did to go meet her in Poland before she passed away. She died well into her 90s, but just another story of selflessness and sacrifice. And Shuni Sugihara was a Japanese diplomat who was stationed in Lithuania when Polish Jews started knocking on his door asking for him to write them visas so that they could go into Japan to escape. He asked his government if he could do that, and they told him no, and he decided he had to do it anyway. He hand wrote thousands of visas. The survivors call themselves Sugihara survivors. He was dishonored by his government. His post was taken away. He and his family were actually put in a camp for 18 months. And when he went home, he was completely dishonored. And it wasn't until after his death that the Japanese government erected a statue in his memory on what is now known as the Hill of Humanity. He is in Yad Vashem as one of the righteous Gentiles. But, you know, these people did it because they knew it was the right thing to do. And they thought about, what would I want someone to do for me?
Yeah.
And those are questions we ask. You know, I know my students are thinking, you know, if it were me, what would I want someone to do for me? And I know my students are thinking, would I do that for someone else? And those are the kinds of hard questions, when you said critical thinking,
yep,
that we want them to be addressing.
Sure. And
I think we see today, you know, over the last few years, when we've seen such a rise in public white supremacy and violence and hatred in our country in, you know, the 21st century, which is just wild. You know, lots of people, probably rightly so, point to the Holocaust and note many similarities in those early days. And one of the things that I have been saying over the last, you know, 5-6 years is, look how different the response has been, though. Look how many more people have stood up and said, oh no, we're not doing that. And partly, I think, because we have the internet, because we can talk to each other, which is also part of the reason we see this white supremacy so much on the rise as well. But also, I think partly because these are the lessons we've been explicitly teaching for generations now. And people, I think, have started to learn to do better and not stay silent. And it's so scary. It's so scary to stand up and say something, but it's much better to stand up together and say something and try to resist, which I think we've done an excellent job over the last few years in this country of resisting.
So I wanna say that many of our listeners are parents and grandparents and other people helping to raise children who aren't actually trained educators. And on this podcast, we talk about not only the values we wanna pass on to our kids, but also some of the hard topics that we have to address in order to like truly live out those values. So I'm wondering if you have some ideas, like what should our listeners know about how to talk to children about difficult stories, and this, you know, in terms of developmental ideas or tips, questions, things like that, ways to talk to small children if you're not an educator and outside of the classroom.
I think that when you talk to young children, you've got to remember that they're actually capable of a lot more than we think they are. Some of the vocabulary might be difficult for them to understand, but concepts of just people being unkind and cruel or unfair to others is a concept that I think young children, it's very real in their lives. They're constantly all day long talking about what's fair and noticing what other people have and what they don't have. And so that's something that they can really identify with. And so I think that especially talking to children up until about, I would say 7 or 8 years old, even 9 or 10, depending on your child, you know, just talking about different cultures and different people as people, taking the time to research about them. And if you don't have time for research, there's amazing books out there. Children's literature has really taken off. It's just amazing, the books that you can get out there. And I really suggest, if you have not done so yet, go talk to your children's librarian at your local library. They are a wealth of knowledge. They know all the new books that are coming out. I know here I was very pleasantly surprised. I was in my local Barnes and Noble children's section and I was looking for a particular book, and the manager there explained to me that, you know, at these big bookshops, they can't keep, if the book is on the shelf for more than a certain number of weeks and they don't sell enough copies, they just can't give it the shelf space. That doesn't mean they can't get the book or that they don't have the book. They just can't display it. So she said, the more people who buy those books, the more likelihood you're going to see those books on the shelf. And so she printed out, I think it was like 12 pages of books on, at that particular time, I was looking for a transgender LGBTQ, some books from my library for a particular situation. And she gave me a list of, it was like 10 pages with really small font of books that I could possibly get. So there are so many books. I feel like, I can't for sure say this, but I feel confident saying the majority of topics that you would like to talk about with your children, you will be able to find a children's book that will touch upon it. There are some wonderful books out there for sure that are being written even now.
Yeah.
There's one that comes right to mind is Dreamers, is about a Mexican mom and child who migrate to LA and how they don't know the language and they feel very displaced. And they walk into a public library and realize that they have access to whatever they want there. And the mother ends up learning English. And actually, it's a true story. The author is the woman. And so she ends up learning the language. But it's a great story to talk about immigration, migration, joining a new culture. And it's people and their beautiful illustrations, and it's very true to the culture. And so there's just so many authentic books that it doesn't have to be an animal or a teddy bear that goes through some all, you know, there's wonderful stories with real people facing real challenges.
The book Terrible Things by Eve Bunting is an allegory for the Holocaust. An allegory is when you take a very difficult topic and you make it very simple using symbolism. Mm-hmm. And the way that this book is written, you could read it to a kindergarten class, and it would be valuable because it talks about how when each group of animals is being taken away, all the other animals are, A, it's relieved that it's not them, and B, they kind of bad talk the group of animals that was taken and think of reasons why they might have been taken. It's almost like a blame the victim kind of attitude. Mm-hmm. And with each group of animals that gets taken, it's more of the same, relief that it's not them and bad mouthing the group that was taken. So in primary grades, K-1 and 2, you could absolutely use that book and talk about, you know, what could the animals have done? What could the other animals have done instead of allowing this group of animals to be taken away? But the older students, after they learn about the Holocaust, they totally see the symbolism and what is going on and who the terrible things are symbolizing, etc. So that's a wonderful book that I recommend for all age groups.
And that's definitely a book that, you know, parents can read to their kids. It doesn't have to be in the classroom. You know, you can
absolutely,
you know, and you know, that's a book that you could read and just have a conversation with your kid about.
And also Adina mentioned, you know, like you can read it in kindergarten, first and second grade and talk very literally about the animals and what the animals can do, and then read it again when they're older and talk about the allegory of it. And so I think that's another thing. I think a lot of parents, by the time children start reading chapter books, think get rid of the picture books, they're too mm-hmm. easy for them. But a lot of these picture books is where the harder conversations lie, where you can really have those conversations. And so just because your child is a, you know, a very avid reader, a very advanced reader, doesn't mean that these books cannot be re-looked at or reread and discussed a little bit more deeply in the older grades. So I really encourage parents, if you do get books that are terrific, like The Terrible Things, don't put them in the giveaway bin as soon as they reach the age where they're reading chapter books, second and third grade.
And I will say also, you know, I still read to my, you know, 12 and a half year old at bedtime. And we still, and, you know, we are reading, you know, we read The Hate U Give together and we read The Diary of Anne Frank together. So we are reading books at his level, but keeping that bedtime reading, even though obviously he's a reader, has really been helpful in terms of continuing to have conversations about things that he might, you know, read on his own and form opinions on and not really think to bounce them off of other people.
And just to bounce off that, just like you said, Hina, about books being different in children's brains at different ages, the same can be true for some movies. We showed The Sound of Music at the end of our Holocaust unit this year. So many students had already seen it at a very young age. This time, they saw it through completely different eyes when I said, look for signs of the Nazi occupation in Austria. Then they realized, oh my gosh, there was a Nazi flag that was hung in his house and the captain ripped it down. And what was the reason that the whole family fled? Why did they leave? Because he was being forced to go and be a captain for the Nazis. So then they, wow, this is really a movie kind of about, it has tinges of the Holocaust. It's not about the Holocaust, but definitely there's a background there that if you don't have the background, you just kind of overlook it. And similarly with other books, when I talked about Number of the Stars, Number of the Stars really is probably a fourth grade level book, but we use it in fifth grade because we have the background.
Yeah.
We understand what is going on in the world around Denmark and why what they did was so amazing. If a student reads it without any knowledge of the Holocaust, they're missing a whole piece mm-hmm. and it's being read in a vacuum. So yeah. Pay attention to, you know, the grade level, yes, but also about the background information.
And I think picture books too, I mean, obviously I'm a young early childhood educator, but I feel like picture books are shorter. So you can consume the whole book in a matter of 5-10 minutes, maybe 15-20. And then it gives you time to have that discussion afterwards. You know, I read with my older students, older children, my own personal children. And, you know, the chapter books take a little bit longer. So sometimes we forget to have the discussion after every chapter. There wasn't something to talk about in that chapter. So I think that picture books have come an incredibly long way, and to disregard them would really be harmful. I think it's important to honor them. I think that they do have great topics.
Absolutely. And I also think that I'm just thinking about one of Robin and my favorite podcasts, Critically Examines Harry Potter. And it's, you know, it's one of our faves. It's called Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. And these two friends began it, or three friends, really, the two hosts and the producer, when they were at the Harvard Divinity School, and they've long since graduated, but they used the Harry Potter books like as though they were a sacred text in a religion, and how you would read that. And the lessons can be very deep when you take the time to critically look at fiction. I think fiction can really help open people's eyes, because it sort of erases some of our defensive feelings. It erases some of our, no, that's not right, it was this way or that way. No, it's whatever way the author said it was, isn't it? Because it's fiction. And then you can really begin to understand lessons that are real world lessons. So I think also, I'm just thinking as both of you are talking, that looking to what your children are reading or what they are watching, and looking for those lessons there as well as an opening point for those.
And I will say, add to that, I think that Asher, you know, my son Asher, is a lot of his learning about the Holocaust from, you know, starting, you know, we started with that conversation, like I mentioned, when he was four, but a lot of his learning through the years came from PJ Library and PJ Arway books, where there's a lot, you know, he got a lot of, and they are fiction for the most part, or, you know, his historical fiction is his favorite genre. So those were always the ones he chose and gravitated toward. But, you know, he got a lot of stories about people that weren't just, this is what happened, this is the, you know, this is the history of it. He got a lot of stories from those books. And some of them are meant for very small kids. Like they, you know, they handle them very sort of very gently and appropriately, I think. And he sought those out on his own, really continued to. Through his tween years.
There are a couple of other books I would recommend that are about Holocaust heroes. The book about Shuni Sugihara is called The Passage to Freedom, The Sugihara Story. There's a book that is about Nicholas Winton that just came out this year. It's called Nikki and Vera, and it's a children's book. And these are one-sit reads, like Hina was saying. A one-sit read, you can sit and read it in one day. And it's geared towards children. And the Irena Sendler book I would recommend is called Life in a Jar.
And the only, I'm thinking about tips and ideas to talk to children, you know, the other thing I would say that you can do it, I think, up until about 8 or 9, then they start to get a little bit more self-conscious. But if you, as a parent or as an educator, are having difficulty breaching these conversations because you feel like you're going to be put on the spot, another suggestion that I could have, that I would give, is to just draw, free draw, and draw next to them. And the act of drawing is very helpful. Things will come up there, but really we put a lot of emphasis on children giving eye contact and looking right at us and having serious conversations by looking at us. That puts a lot of seriousness and pressure. And a lot of times children will shut down and feel like they have to have the right answer, or they have to be listening and proper about it all. And so if you can do any activity, dishes in the car, when you don't have eye contact naturally, sometimes you get more information and children will listen more deeply because they don't feel like they're put on the spot. They don't feel like they're performing, and that they're just, it makes it casual. And that casualness allows them to hear things in a deeper way that sometimes they don't hear when you're talking face to face or sitting down and having a serious conversation. So
I second that. I mean, I've definitely, some of the most fruitful conversations I've had with my son over the years have been either in the car, less so now that he's in the front seat with me, but certainly more so when he was in the back seat, and sometimes just laying in bed at night, but side by side, but with our eyes closed, you know, before he goes to bed, after we've read maybe, but not looking at each other. That has definitely yielded some important questions that he might not sort of come to or come out with.
Okay, this is the part where we challenge each other to try something this week and ask our listeners to do it too.
Okay, so for this week, we're asking everyone to commit to teaching a little bit of hard history to someone. And this is pretty open-ended. It could be something big, like introducing the Holocaust to a fifth or sixth grader who doesn't know about it, or reframing the Thanksgiving story in an age-appropriate way for a small kid. It could be something smaller and more personal, like something that happened in your family or town that you don't want to see repeated. But whatever it is that you choose, it should be something that you had maybe glossed over or intentionally forgot in the past, quote unquote, forgot, but that you realize is actually pretty important to preserve the memory of. So for me, I'm actually going to take this opportunity to talk about Thanksgiving. I've done this before when my son was really little. We read books that sort of told the actual story of Thanksgiving instead of the like whole pilgrims and sharing a meal and all of that stuff. But I don't know that he actually remembers it the way that, you know, we did it a long time ago. And I sort of thought, all right, one and done. But it occurs to me that I remember things from his very young childhood, but he really doesn't anymore. So I'm going to do that again, and I'm going to do it pretty intentionally, even though he's pretty big and has a good sense of that stuff. So that's my plan.
Well, you definitely stole my plan as well. So I need the same commitment. It's okay. I mean, with Thanksgiving coming up, that's where we're at.
Yeah.
And certainly, you know, my younger child, my son, is learning that story. This is something that happens a lot in elementary school. I did start asking him a few questions about that, and it seems like they're getting a little better about saying, well, this is one of the stories we tell. And he kind of understood that it wasn't really the story, but I think it's time for us to really have a deeper conversation about that and recognize there's beauty in Thanksgiving, and that it's this lovely secular holiday that brings people together around food and gratitude. And there's also a really dark history around how we have, you know, painted a certain kind of picture of our history that's wildly inaccurate. So being able to recognize both.
And I think that, yeah. And I think that that's actually, it's kind of a, I'm thinking about like the way that I talked to Asher about it when he was little and the books that we read and sort of the way that you'll talk to your 7-year-old versus the way that we will talk to our middle schoolers. It'll be different. Like, if, you know, it's definitely, it's not going to be that same conversation about like, this isn't the actual Thanksgiving. Like, I think it's going to be, it's able to be a little more real and a little more, you know, I hesitate to say graphic, but I think it will be. I think that we can be more honest with our kids as they get older.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to that, and also not at the same time.
Yeah, definitely.
It really highlights our sort of terribleness in our history. So for our listeners, what commitment can you make? We'd love to hear about it. Send us a voice memo at goodkidsbetterworld@gmail.com. Tweet us or tag us on Facebook at Good Kids Better World. Adina and Hina, this was amazing. Like, I feel like we've gotten so much information. I think it's going to be so useful for parents, and also really great to have sort of a window into the classroom, because we're not, aside from this weird year when we were next to them constantly, we're not with them. And so we don't necessarily see what they're being taught and how they're being taught it. And it's refreshing and wonderful to see that, you know, there are some really hard things being taught really thoughtfully. So thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for including me. I think this is a wonderful thing. And I love that you start with saying that good kids are striving to make a better world. That is the tenet of Tikkun Olam.
So yeah, we believe it. We definitely believe it.
Thank you both so much.
And thank you for listening and joining us on our journey to raise good kids who will make a better world. If you like the show, please tell your friends. You can subscribe to our podcast on our website or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a review to help more people find us. You can join the conversation on our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/goodkidsbetterworld. And please visit our website for show notes and links at goodkidsbetterworld.com.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.